turning in the plow. For revolutions will never die. To be with them or be without. A fever blowing away from. Fade down Piers Ficinian by Lucky Sissoko, a beautiful song, and let you know that this is the end of the Hejira World Music Radio Show, for today that is. Jeff Spitzer-Resnick, your host here on WORT 89.9 FM. I want to thank Michael for contributing to our After Pledge Drive Appreciate that. All pledges will be doubled through Sunday. BBC News coming up next, followed by A Public Affair with Richard Wolff as the guest on talking about global capitalism here on WORT 89.9 FM in Madison.
The news.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. President Putin has given qualified support to the idea of a 30-day ceasefire in the war in Ukraine, but has raised a series of questions that he said needed discussing with the United States. His words have been voiced by a translator.
What happened during those 30 days? Would that allow Ukraine to continue a forced mobilization? What about verification? Who will give orders to cease hostilities? Who will decide where there's been a violation all along the 2,000-kilometer line, and who will be blamed?
His comments come ahead of a meeting in Moscow with President Trump's personal envoy, Steve Witkoff. He'll be presenting the US proposals, which have been agreed in principle by Ukraine under pressure from Washington. Southern African leaders have decided to end their military mission in eastern Congo, ordering a phased troop withdrawal. Their regional summit called for urgent efforts to end the conflict as troops begin pulling out. Meanwhile, Angola says peace talks between the DRC government and Rwanda-backed M23 rebels will begin next week. Shunga Nyoka reports from Harare.
Southern Africa began its mission in the DRC in December 2023 to help the Congolese army fight rebel groups. South Africa, Tanzania, and Malawi deployed troops. In recent months, as fighting intensified, the mission had suffered heavy casualties at the hands of the M23 rebel group, prompting Malawi to announce the withdrawal of its troops. No reason was given for the decision to end the mission.
Israel has strongly rejected a UN report accusing it of systematic use of sexual and reproductive violence against Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the Human Rights Council an anti-Semitic, irrelevant body. Speaking in Geneva, a member of the UN Commission, Chris Sidoti, listed its findings.
Sexual and gender-based violence is increasingly used as a method of war by Israel to destabilize, dominate, oppress and destroy the Palestinian people. The Commission documented a pattern of sexual violence, including cases of rape and other forms of sexual violence, torture and other inhumane acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Syria's interim president has signed a constitutional declaration setting out the country's governance over a five-year transition. Ahmed al-Sharaa said he hoped it would mark the start of a new history for Syria that replaced oppression with justice. Laws will be subject to Islamic jurisprudence. The committee in charge of the declaration said it enshrines freedom of opinion. It said women's social, political and economic rights were also enshrined in the document. BBC News. Prosecutors in Belgium have said the Chinese telecoms giant Huawei is suspected of benefiting from allegedly corrupt lobbying practices targeting the European Parliament. Several people have been detained for questioning in Belgium and Portugal. One person has been arrested in France. Danny Eberhard reports.
Belgian prosecutors believe bribes were paid for political backing and that those lobbied were courted with excessive gifts or tickets to football matches. Investigators have not named any suspects, but they say judges have requested that the offices of two European parliamentary assistants be sealed. They'd need special permission to search them. Huawei has yet to comment. It's faced pressure from regulators in Europe and elsewhere over its links to the Chinese government amid fears over spying and national security. It's denied supplying data to the government in Beijing.
The number of reported cases of measles in Europe and Central Asia has reached its highest level in more than 25 years. The World Health Organization said infections doubled in 2024 to almost 128,000. Children under the age of five accounted for more than 40% of the measles cases in the region. Pope Francis is spending the 12th anniversary of his papacy in hospital in Rome, where he's recovering from serious health problems, including pneumonia. The Vatican said the Pope was shown hundreds of goodwill messages as he continues his treatment. Donatella Versace is to stand down as creative officer of the luxury fashion label she's led since 1997. Versace's owner, Capri Holdings Limited, said she would from April become chief brand ambassador. Donatella took over the creative direction of Versace after the murder of her brother Gianni in 1997. Versace's new creative officer will be Dario Vitale, who left Miu Miu in January. BBC News.
Along with our listener sponsors, WRT would like to thank our local business supporters for helping us bring you great shows like this one. We never could have made it to our 50th year without our program underwriters. When you visit these businesses, please take a moment to thank them for their support of WORT. Your acknowledgement of their support really matters. A complete list of our underwriters is on our website at WORTFM.org. Does your business wish to join the party and become a WORT underwriter? Let our listeners know you support independent media. For more information about WORT underwriting, event sponsorships, or to obtain a logo tile on our popular WORTFM app, contact Doug Holtz at 608-321-9597 or visit the staff page on our website at WORTFM.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We
bring the and good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. So how do we begin to decipher the increasing levels of international antagonism and how they relate to what has been occurring socially, economically, and politically in the United States? How do we reach some clearer understanding of what is taking place, the connection between the domestic national and the foreign global in the current period? Joining us to discuss a number of seemingly unrelated but interconnected concerns, economic and political, is our guest today, economist Richard D. Wolff, a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Wolff currently is a visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York. He previously taught economics at Yale and the City College of New York, and formerly was a visiting professor of economics at the Sorbonne. Professor Wolff is the co-founder of Democracy at Work, an alternative online site featuring economic analysis and commentary. He hosts the DAW's nationally syndicated show, Economics Update. Richard Wolff, welcome, welcome. It's been a long time, so welcome back to WRT.
It's a great pleasure, Alan. I really enjoy my times here, and I'm glad that they're happening again.
Good, good. You know, Richard, I'd like to begin with a big question, a way perhaps to frame our discussion. In one of your recent commentaries, you stated that we live at a crucial historical moment. How so? What makes it such?
Okay, I'm going to answer your question, but allow me a momentary preface.
Sure.
I want to remind everyone that I'm just the messenger, and if the message is difficult, that's not my fault. I'm just the messenger, so please bear with me on that. The answer to your question, what you might call the big picture that we all face if we're Americans and alive today, is that the United States enjoyed, particularly across the second half of the 20th century, when I lived most of my life, something that really deserves the name the American Empire. World War II is when this kind of really got going, because that was the war that brought to an end every other country that might have aspired to being the new empire, because the British Empire had already been dying for half a century. World War II was the end of that. You know, the jewel in the so-called crown of the British Empire was India, and by 1947, India had achieved its independence under the leadership of Mahatma Gandhi, and many people know that story, or at least parts of it. And who would replace the dead British Empire? The Germans had aspirations, the Japanese had aspirations, but they were destroyed in World War II. The British and the French might have imagined coming back from their destroyed empires, but they too were destroyed in World War II, as was Russia, Soviet Union. So what emerged at the end of World War II, 1945, was the United States. Other than Pearl Harbor at the beginning, no bombs fell on the United States. No factories were destroyed, no rail lines were obliterated, and relatively fewer people were wounded or killed than any of those other countries in terms of the percent of their populations affected. So in 1945, the United States is king of the hill. It is the emerging economy that is not only the best in the best shape of all the others, but given how destroyed they were, all the others had to look at rebuilding from the war, and the United States was where they turned for the machines and the equipment and the raw materials and the financing to make it all possible, which only enlarged. The US dollar became the global currency, as it has been pretty much since that time. We found it, we the US, founded institutions like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. We hosted the United Nations. Symbolically and really, we were the new empire. We developed a ring of 700, and they're still there, 700 military bases around the world. No other country had ever had that before. No other country has ever had that since. So we were dominant. Now, the important thing is the dominance couldn't possibly last. Why do I say that? Because every other empire, the Greek, the Roman, the Persian, the Ottoman, whichever one you want to pick, they all had a ride up and then they all had a ride down. No global empire ever lasted forever, not even close. And therefore, the only reasonable thing Americans should have understood is that, well, you're in a very charmed position now, but it can't last. Well, that didn't happen. What we did instead was convince ourselves as a nation that we are the exception. We are the unusual. Our prosperity will last forever. Our dominance will last forever. Anybody who challenges it must be very evil, because not only are we the empire now, but we are the best thing to happen to the human race since the beginning. We are prosperous. We are democratic. We have liberty. It was a self-celebration, which, depending on where you stood, was either very impressive or egomaniacal, or maybe a little mixture of both of them. Well, the good news is we enjoyed it for a while. The bad news is no more. Starting around 2010, 2015, we began to peak, and we are now in a period of decline. And let me show you some of the dimensions, and then I can speak to how it affects us here in the U.S. We lost the wars after World War II. We ended with a stalemate in Korea in 1950. We lost the war in Vietnam in 1975. Let me remind everyone, that was a war against the Communist Party of North Vietnam. And for those of you who don't know, after that war was lost, since 1975, the rulers of that country, now unified as Vietnam, is the Communist Party that descended from North Vietnam. So our enemies run the country. We lost. In Afghanistan, more recently, we went to war against the Taliban. We left there a few years ago. And who runs the Afghanistan today? The Taliban. We lost. They won. I could go on. I could tell you about Iraq. I could tell you about what's happening in Ukraine. These are all losses. And you have to begin to ask the question. Here was the United States at war with some of the poorest countries on this planet, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and we lost. We are now discovering in Ukraine that if you go to war against something that isn't a poor country, you don't do so well either. We have to face that. We also have to face that one of the many countries that over the last century belonged to what we used to call the third world, or what was called the underdeveloped world, or what now likes the name the global south. These were the poor countries, mostly ex-colonies of the rich countries of Europe. They got their independence after World War II, but it was only political. Only in the last 10 years, 20 years, did they begin to get genuine economic independence, and that only to limited degrees, but enough so that the following happened. One of them figured out how to become no longer one of the poorest countries on earth. It figured out, with much copying from the West, just like the West earlier copied from the East. But this new country, and I'll give you the name if you haven't guessed it, the People's Republic of China, put together an economic development program which has been more successful than any other economic development program in the history of the human race. Over the last 40 years, China went from not only the most populous country in the world, population over a billion, but it also went from extreme poverty to being the number two economy in the world today, only slightly less than the U.S. and likely to catch up to the U.S. before the end of this decade that we are already halfway through. China is the phenomena, and China has carefully built a network of alliances known as the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, originally stood for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but now includes 20 more countries. Why am I telling you this? Because the economic footprint, the size, the global importance of China and the BRICS can be captured in the statistics we use in economics called the GDP, the gross domestic product. We add up what is the total GDP, and by the way, that's just a measure of the output of goods and services in one calendar year. So we measure the GDP of China and its BRICS allies on the one hand, and of the United States and our major allies. It's known as the G7, United States, Canada, Japan, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. Now those, the G7, is the old dominant economic power of the world. the one who set up all the colonies, who literally ruled the world. But today, if you add up the GDP of the G7, it is about, they produce about 28% of the world's goods and services every year. But if you look at China and its allies in the BRICS, they produce about 35%. It's over. The dominant economic wealth and power is now not in the United States. And this is the first time in a century that that has been the case. That's why we're at a historical changing point. We are in an economy in the down phase. That's not a death sentence. That doesn't mean the world is coming to an end, but it is a big, powerful reality. Every country in the world, everyone, and every major company in the world is rethinking its strategy, where it hopes to sell whatever it produces, where it hopes to find the inputs to produce whatever it makes, where to go for a loan, where to see its future. They are now rethinking. They used to think in terms of the United States and the G7 and Europe. They still think about them, but they now have an option. They can go to Beijing. They can go to New Delhi. They can go to Sao Paulo in Brazil and get a loan. If they need a railroad built, you know where most of the railroads in Africa, who's building them? The Chinese. You know who's building the big harbors in Latin America? The Chinese. Hello. It's time for us to recognize that we live in a very different world. Because if we don't, if we continue the American habit, understandable, but nonetheless unaffordable, we can't keep denying this. We can't keep pretending. 2 weeks ago, President Trump was asked about the BRICS. He said, it's all dead. They're all dead. Okay, I understand where this silly remark comes from, but it's not a way to deal with a changed global reality.
You're listening to Professor Economist Richard Wolff. We'll be opening up the phone lines at half past the hour, as is usual, at 608-256-2001 if you want to join the conversation with a question, a comment, an observation. Again, 608-256-2001. Richard Wolff, following President Trump's March 4th address to the joint session of Congress, you posted a response the next day that focused on two issues seemingly separate, but certainly connected. First, on the domestic front, the mass firing of federal employees, and secondly, on the international level, the disintegration of the relationship between the U.S. and the longtime major allies in Western Europe, part of what you were talking about, of course. I want to start with the firing of all these public employees. Talk about what you have described as, quote, the absurdity of Trump Musk's attack on federal workers. After all, just yesterday, Musk's freewheeling DOGE ramped up its onslaught on the Department of Education, eliminating thousands more jobs and, in effect, axing numbers of programs. Talk about that. You say that the language of which is being sold as is phony.
Yes, let's begin with that. It's called the Department of Governmental Efficiency. That's what DOGE stands for, and that's what Musk and Trump are celebrating. So they want us to think that this is an effort to make the government more efficient. Well, let's talk about that because, as you'll see, that's silly. And I'm using the word silly because it's polite. I could use stronger language if you wish. I will do that. Okay, why is it silly? Well, let's see. The federal employees in America, that's the people who are paid a salary and hired by the federal government in Washington. They divide into two kinds, civilian and military. I'm not going to talk about the military because no one else is talking about them. He's not proposing to fire lots of, you know, corporals and foot soldiers and sailors and all of that. So let's focus on the civilian employees, because that's the one he's going after, and that's the one that is getting all the publicity, okay? How many of them roughly are there? Answer, 2.5 million. 2.5 million people. Now, let's get that clear in our heads. What is the size of the labor force in America? 160 to 170 million people. So he's going to deal with this problem he wants us to think is so urgent that he's going to overnight fire tens of thousands. He's talking about a group of 2.5 million people. That's all. And here I can show you how silly this is. If you want to deal with the inefficiency of the government, let's remember we have three levels of government in the United States: the federal, the state, and the local. The federal government employs 2.5 million people. How many people are employed by state governments in America? The answer, 5 million, twice as many. And how many people are employed by the local governments in America? 15 million. So if you put the state and local together, you got 20 million people. If you're looking for efficiency, that's where you would go, not the 2.5 million at the top in the federal government, unless you had some argument that the federal are less efficient than the state and local, and absolutely no one, including Mr. Trump, has ever made that argument, and nobody could. But I'm only getting started. Let me give you a second, then I'll stop. Let me give you a second. I did the little bit of research. I asked myself, gee, maybe they've become more efficient because they're just piling on federal employees. So I looked at how many people worked for the federal government back at the turn of the century, the year 2000, and even further back in the 1960s. And I discovered what anyone will, if you just go and do the research, take about 10 minutes, that in the 1960s, the number of people working in the civilian labor force for the federal government was, 2.5 million. And at the turn of the century, it was, 2.5 million. And what is it today? 2.5 million. But here's the interesting thing. Back in the 1960s, the United States population was 200 million people. Today, it's 340 million people. We've increased our population spectacularly, but we haven't required greater numbers of federal employees. And in economics, if you service more and more people with the same number of people, we call that efficiency. That's all the word means. So Mr. Trump is counting, and Mr. Musk, they are performing a political theater. They are dancing around and making sure no one knows the absurdity of claiming that you're involved with efficiency, given the very few statistics I've just presented.
Take it a little bit further. That is, give some historical context. In one of your videos that I watched this week, you talked about the significance of the 2017 tax cuts to the wealthy under Trump, and how that doesn't get addressed at all. Taking it out of the hides of, well, the popular classes.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. One of the largest tax cuts ever given in the United States was the one that was passed during Mr. Trump's first presidency in the year 2017, in December of that year. Mr. Trump had a very pliable Congress, so they gave him that tax cut. It was remarkable in two ways. Number one, the bulk of the tax cut went to corporations and to the richest people among us. And the second remarkable thing was It came at the end of a 40-year period, roughly 1980 to roughly 2020, during which the stock market had its greatest boom ever, making the 10% of Americans who own 80% of the stocks wildly richer than they had ever been. So you could really argue that in 2017, the corporations and the rich had come off the best 30 to 40 years they had ever experienced in American history, making them less needy for a tax cut than they had ever been. And just when they were minimally needy, their friendly president gave them an enormity. Okay, now let's follow very easily where that goes. If you suddenly give a tax cut to corporations and the rich, saving them many, many billions, with a B, billions of dollars, that's money that they don't have to pay to Uncle Sam because they got the tax cut. So now Uncle Sam doesn't have the money to maintain the roads, to fund the hospitals, to help the universities, to pay off Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of it. The government is kind of trapped. One of the things the government then thinks about doing is cutting services, which they did, but they couldn't cut very much because it would produce a vote against them, which is what happened, why Mr. Trump didn't get his second administration back in 2020. So what happened was the government, fearing cutting because they hadn't raised the taxes on corporations and the rich, turned around and did what governments in capitalist economies often do. They borrowed the money. They could continue to pay out the money they needed for the people, even though they didn't raise it in taxes, by borrowing, going into debt, running what we call budget deficits. That's just a way of saying borrowing the money. And if you understand economics, you will enjoy with me the following. When you don't tax corporations and the rich, and so you don't have the money coming in, and you decide to deal with that by borrowing, who do you go to borrow from? You can't go to the working class because they don't have any money. So you go to corporations and the rich, and you borrow from them. And what are you borrowing from them? The money they have to lend because you didn't tax them. So for corporations and the rich, this is the greatest game in the world. Instead of paying a tax, kiss your money goodbye, they're able to take that same money, lend it to the government, and the government will, after a few years, pay them back, and while they're waiting, pay them an interest. And you know where they're going to get the money to do that? By taxing the rest of us. So when you hear Mr. Trump or Mr. Musk go on the television and tell you, well, we have to cut these government jobs, we're wasting money, well, because, you know, we don't want to have to borrow, here's what they're really telling you. We already borrowed. We don't want to borrow more. And in order to have the money to pay back the rich people we didn't tax, I'm going to fire you, you clerk, you secretary, you administrator, you whatever. I'm going to take the money I no longer pay you for the job I fired you from. I'm going to take that money and, yep, I'm going to give it to the corporations and the rich because I owe them the interest and the principal that I borrowed from them since I wouldn't tax them. The American working class is being hustled here 10 different ways and ought to be outraged.
You know, part of that, of course, is that we're now seeing the beginnings of an assault long time in coming. It's been given lip service to by conservatives and Republicans for some time. But an assault on Social Security telegraphed in Trump's speech last week. Talk about that, your thoughts on that, what that could come to mean.
Sure. in order to do that, let me remind people of a couple of things. For most of the history of the United States, we didn't have Social Security. Social Security is something that came into existence during the depths of the Depression of the 1930s, when the president was Franklin Roosevelt, Democratic Party, and when there was an enormous degree of political mobilization of the labor movement and of two socialist and one communist party, all of whom were strong in the 1930s. They all got together in something that came to be known as the New Deal coalition of that time, and they put a lot of pressure on the president. And they said, look, we're in a depression. One out of four American workers is without a job. Every family is in trouble economically. We can't sustain our elderly, our parents, who've given a lifetime to work in our factories and offices, who've raised us as their children. Something has to be done in this time. And Mr. Roosevelt, there was a long story we can go into if you're interested, good politician, he knew he had to do something. Out of that came the Social Security system, a commitment by the United States government to provide a pension check every month to people who reached the age in those days of 65 for the rest of their lives, no matter how long they may live. It was something done to alleviate suffering. It was something done to deal with economic problems that the private sector couldn't and wouldn't deal with. Well, our population has grown. One of the remarkable things about Social Security is that it was set up as a pay-as-you-go system. Here's what that means. People working have money withheld from their check. Let me make sure everybody understands. It may be called an entitlement, but it's an entitlement that the working class has paid for. It's not a government handout. It's not charity, nothing of that sort. Ask anybody who works for a living, and they will tell you about how week after week, money is held out of your paycheck, sent to Washington, that holds it and accumulates it so it can be paid out to you when you reach age 65. Since our population has grown dramatically since the 1930s, that's nearly a century of rapid growth, the Social Security system has expanded. Then, after World War II, we added a medical care program for 65-year-old, Medicare. And that's also funded by withholding from people's checks. But the reality is our population is changing. We have more and more old people who are pulling money out of the Social Security system that they're entitled to. And we have fewer and fewer young people putting money in to fund the money being taken out by the old. Now, we were doing okay because we solved this problem by bringing in large numbers of immigrants, because they come usually at the age of 20, 25, which means they're in their prime working years. And when they go to work, money is pulled out of their paycheck to fund Social Security. If we now deport these immigrants, which is what Trump and Musk are doing, you're taking away the money that could be coming in. Meanwhile, our aging population keeps pulling the money out. Therefore, here we go, there's a problem coming down the pike. We're not going to have enough coming in to pay what's going out. This is not a problem that drops out of the heaven. This is a problem well understood and known for many, many years. But the political problem is, how are you going to fix this? One way to do it is to tax corporations and the rich. They won't have it. They will kill the political career of the few who dare, let's say, let's do that. What's the conservatives? They want to either take more money out of working people who are young, or, here we go, cut the benefits of the elderly. Cut the benefits that were promised to them and for which they paid. That's what conservatives want to do. They want to either hurt young workers or hurt older workers. They don't really much care what combination, as long as you don't touch corporations and the rich to get the money, which of course you could do if you didn't give them the crazy tax cut in 2017 that we just discussed. You'd have the money to fix Social Security for the rest of this century. Don't let anyone tell you this is something that requires punishing older people or punishing younger people. That's not the way we ought to go. It's not the way we ought to think.
You're listening to Richard Wolff, economist, emeritus professor of economics at UMass Amherst. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 if you want to get in with a question, a comment, an observation. Again, we're already well past the half hour, and the time goes quickly, so if you want to get in, give us a call now. Richard Wolff, I'd like to turn our attention to the lead story in yesterday's news cycle, the usually boring and mundane but now volatile front page issue of tariffs. Talk about tariff wars, economic nationalism, and what they have led to in the past.
Well, the sad and the scary news is that tariff wars have in the past led to trade wars, which have in the past, not always, but have in the past, eventually led to military wars, which is why in most cases human beings have decided to cancel them if they've started with them or not to start with them at all. And the reason is they're a two-edged sword. The simplest way to say it is what you see in the papers every day. Mr. Trump hits, let's say, Canada with a tariff, and 2 days later, Mr. Trudeau, or whoever runs Canada, hits back with a tariff against the United States. The United States has been tariffing China. China has hit back with its tariffs. So what a tariff does is say, and by the way, a tariff is simply a funny name for a tax. It's a tax on imported goods and services. That's all. It should be called an import tax. And in earlier parts of America, it was. It used to be called an import tax or an import duty, D-U-T-Y. Later on, it got called a tariff. It's just a tax. And by the way, let everyone note that the Republican Party of Mr. Trump, which prided itself in the last century for being the anti-tax party in America, is now advocating mammoth taxes on us in the name of these tariffs. They like to call them a tariff, hoping you don't know that it's just another tax, only this one is being hit. We're being hit by a tax from a Republican president who is going to make us pay big time for everything imported from China, Canada, Mexico, Europe. That's all money we pay that goes to Uncle Sam. It's a tax. And it doesn't work because companies are not going to move based on what a politician says, let alone a politician who says it one day, cancels it the next day, reinserts it a day after that. It's impossible to get any kind of change out of that except the retaliation of your trading partners. And what is happening, and I don't mind saying it, is we are isolating the United States from every other part of the world. You don't see them throwing tariffs at each other. It's only the United States doing it, and that is going to make us the bad guy in the world community.
608-256-2001. If you have a question, a comment, an observation, 608-256-2001. Sarah, the program's producer, tells me that Dan from Lake Mills is on the line with some questions. Dan, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Alan, and for Professor Wolf, I have a couple of questions. Very quickly, would I be correct in thinking that apart from the essential efficacy or not efficacy of tariffs themselves, the U.S., certainly not being the world's number one industrial power anymore, would have a very hard time enforcing, to say nothing of benefiting from imposing tariffs on crucial trading partners like China, Canada, and Mexico? And number two, would I necessarily be delusional in thinking, taking into consideration all the harm Trump and Musk are doing to the United States right now, would I necessarily be delusional in thinking that Donald Trump might be in the service of some powerful foreign country or entity?
Let me respond to the easier, the first question. I ended up my comments a few moments ago by saying, in effect, that the United States is isolating itself by this policy. And I believe that. I think many companies, and by the way, there's a story in today's Wall Street Journal that will show you that I'm right about this, at least in part, that many companies are not about to move their production. You know, if you're making auto parts in Mexico and you're shipping them to the United States, which is a big business, you're not going to stop doing that because there's a tariff. You don't like the tariff, but you're not going to spend an enormous amount of money moving a big factory out of Mexico and into, say, Texas or Louisiana or anywhere in the U.S. Why? Because it's very costly, and it takes years to do that. And you don't know when this tariff is put into effect how long it will last. Will it be the same? Will Mr. Trump undo the tariff, which he's already done more than once with all of the tariffs? You know, this is a constant political game, and a corporation isn't going to take the risk of investing huge sums to do something which will look ridiculous 6 months from now, or May, because of the way the tariffs are being used. Let me put it another way. To move production back into the United States, to re-industrialize the United States, is a matter of decades. That's how long it took us to industrialize, and that's how long it'll take us to do it again. And if we do, the workers you hire will expect to be paid American-level wages. But those are much higher than the rest of the world, which means the products that you produce here will have to be priced much higher than those in the rest of the world, which means the people in the rest of the world, and let's remember the United States only has 4.5% of the world's population, if we outprice ourselves by reindustrializing, nobody will buy our goods because they'll be too expensive. Because precisely in the rest of the world, they're not doing this, and therefore they don't have the tariff problem. The industrialization has moved, as you know, to China, to India, to Vietnam, to Brazil, and so on. You know, the train has left the station, and you can bemoan the train, you can be regretful about the train, but you can't pretend that by yelling very loudly, the train will go into reverse. It doesn't work like that. And part of what Mr. Trump and Mr. Musk are doing, because it gives them a short-term advantage in elections, is promising what they cannot, in fact, deliver. And Americans who don't want to face that our empire is declining, who don't want to face that our economy is in deep trouble, well, they are to be sympathized with for falling for promises that look good. Whether Mr. Trump is working for somebody else, my opinion isn't worth any. I don't know, therefore, I really can't give you a reasonable answer.
Sarah tells me that there's another Dan, or is it Don this week, is on the line with a question about the volatility of the stock market. I was going in that direction, so let's take it from there.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. All right. I just read a post on social media last week that suggested that there was method behind the madness of imposing a tariff and then rescinding it and then reimposing it and then rescinding it, that it creates this up and down volatility in the market, which profiteers can then take advantage of.
Yeah, let me respond. Every president, not just Mr. Trump, but every president has around him a staff of people who, if you described honestly what they do, here's how it would go. Every time the president does something really stupid, your job is to come up with the really clever thing that he is accomplishing by something that only appears to be stupid. My advice is stay with the original insight. It's stupid. Mr. Trump is doing the tariff dance, which is how it's called around the world, for a simple reason that has nothing to do with some clever plan. When Mr. Trump became president the first time, he learned, which he didn't know before, he learned that unlike most other economic weapons in his arsenal, imposing tariffs doesn't require going through the Congress. It turned out that some years ago, the Congress passed a bill that gave the president remarkable authority all by himself to impose tariffs. Mr. Trump, who is a showman, who's good at that, realized that the tariff was a weapon he could wield. Nobody else could. He could. He could do it without any consulting with anybody else. So he could look the part of really whacking our enemies and so on. Look at his language. We have been cheated. We have been victimized. By the way, it's news to the rest of the world, but it's music to his ears and to those of his followers. I am going to punish the people who have been cheating us. What a lovely story. That's why he does the tariffs. Then when he discovers, to his chagrin, that the tariff he imposed is going to have a backlash, a retaliation, tariffs against Americans, oh my goodness, now he backtracks. Well, I'll find some other way, or maybe we can work it out. And if the other side says, no, we want to do it, then he hits them with a bigger one. The very uncertainty is a terrible thing. Every person on Wall Street, there's a story today in the Wall Street Journal, if you want to check it, about a meeting, the Business Roundtable. That's an association of CEOs of the biggest companies in America. They basically told the president what I'm sure he's been told already. It's not about this or that, Mr. President. It's the uncertainty that kills us, and it kills the economy. We're seriously looking at a recession this year because the business community is postponing its investments because it's too uncertain about the economic future, both of the world economy and of the U.S. economy. You can dance around it with all kinds of stories about some deep indirect policy, but he is costing real jobs, real industrial output by the real decisions his very herky-jerky on and off is causing to happen in our economy. So I don't think there's a big, clever plan behind here. I think he is using a tool that makes him look very important, very powerful, and that he's promising that this will deliver economic good news. The reality is summarized by an official report put out by the Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank last week, which predicts for the United States in the year 2025, this year, a serious recession amounting to a decline of 2% in the total output of goods and services. That will sink Mr. Trump's presidency. I don't think he's doing what he's doing with some ulterior motive in mind, because the cost to him will be too large.
We have a couple callers, as so often, right down to the wire. We have several callers in queue. But I'm going to summarize, because there are some questions, a couple of questions that overlap. And one has to do with the value of the dollar, which you just touched on. But take that a little bit further. You talked about the economy sinking and, well, the international status of the dollar. It's no longer the exchange currency.
Absolutely. The decline of the dollar is just part of the decline of the American empire. Not that many years ago, the dollar was considered, quote unquote, as good as gold, which meant that central banks around the world would hold as reserves in their country to back up their own currency, either gold or the dollar. Well, their holdings of dollar were often in the neighborhood of 70 to 80% of their total reserves were held as dollars. Today, it's estimated to be in the neighborhood of 40 to 45%. That's an incredible drop. It still means the dollar is more of a reserve currency than anything else. That's still true, but way less. The decline of the U.S. doesn't happen in a year or 5 years. It took us a long time to build the economy and the empire. It's going to take a long time. It's going faster than many of us thought, but it is still something that has to be worked out. Yes, the dollar is declining, and it is being replaced not so much by the euro and the yen, Europe and Japan currency, which used to be at least a little of the story. The big story now is the Chinese yuan, because of the enormous footprint. When I mentioned to you before that the United States has 4.5% of the world's people, the BRICS alliance built around China together now has, get ready, 55% of the world's people. We're not even close, and those numbers cannot be waved away as if they weren't as momentous as they ought to be understood to be.
I wanted to leave some time, Richard Wolff, to talk for a moment about your projects. That is Democracy at Work and the Economic Update. Clue people in on these two things.
Yeah, well, if you find this interesting, I do a weekly radio and TV show up on YouTube and so on called Economic Update. Just look it up. You can find it. There's an archive at YouTube. You can access that. And that's where I do a weekly kind of commentary on major economic events. The organization we founded, Democracy at Work, has a website. And it's very simple, democracyatwork.info. All one word, democracyatwork.info. Everything we do is accessible there. In a nutshell, our argument is that the level of difficulty of American capitalism has finally reached the point that we ought to ask and answer a basic question. Maybe the problem isn't in this or that president or this or that policy. Maybe the problem is in the way we've organized our factories, offices, and stores, in the way we organize with a small group of people at the top, the owner, the board of directors, giving orders and controlling a mass of people at the bottom, what we call the employer-employee relationship. We think that's the key problem, and therefore the key solution, get rid of that. Substitute worker co-ops. And I might say that one of the states in the union with the best overall long history, Wisconsin, to your credit. Worker co-ops have been something people have experimented with around the world, and they are, in my judgment, the future.
Well, I want to thank you ever so much. We're right down to the end of the hour. I want those callers that didn't get in with their questions to have a little forbearance here. Richard Wolff, I hope to have you back. The hour goes so, so fast when you're with us. And keep on keeping on doing what you do.
Well, I appreciate there being a station like this that has these kinds of, that dares have these kinds of conversations that are honest, that look at the issues. I'm not interested in persuading everyone to agree with me, not at all. But I am interested in opening these conversations up. I expect to learn from your questions as much as anything I can contribute. And if you want me back, believe me, I believe in this sort of thing, as you can tell, and I'd be glad to come back.
Again, you've been listening this hour to economist Richard Wolff, a man of great accomplishment, and, well, he could talk off the top of his head like no one I know. Thank you ever so much for listening. I've been your John, it was our engineer today. Sarah helped produce. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With an admission that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. President Putin has given qualified support to the idea of a temporary ceasefire in the war in Ukraine, but at a press conference he raised a series of questions that he said needed discussing with the United States.
How will the 30 days be used? Would that allow Ukraine to continue the forced mobilization? For weapons to be supplied there so that those mobilized can be trained? Or will that not be done? And how are control and verification issues to be resolved?